following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
All right, happy Monday, everyone. This is Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're on Heritage Radio Network here at Roberta's Pizza. Happy March to all. I have here today one of the original founding members of the somewhat elusive group known as, known as the Whisk and Ladle Supper Club. And if you've been following a few, press here and there throughout the years about this phenomenon called supper clubs, or if you read my book, which had a lot about it, it seems to be a growing trend or phenomenon or whatever you want to call it, a thing. But Whisk and Ladle has actually been around for 10 years? No.
About seven.
Seven? Yeah. Something really long in the span of this trend. How do you maintain, when you go to Whisk and Ladle site, it's not like, hi, we're the Whisk and sign up here, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of a lot more, exclusive.
Well, I don't think it, Kathy, you've worked with us so many times, so for you to describe it as elusive is almost to think that like we never actually met in person. This is the first time we've ever hung out before, but I feel like we've run into each other so many times.
This is Mark Lowe, by the way. I forgot to introduce.
That's all right. The website, we set it up so long ago, we weren't really looking at other supper clubs to set up a website. Like, what
there
supper
weren't
clubs
any
do?
Were there?
I didn't know of any. I didn't any, even know that there's such a thing. People did that. I lived in an apartment.
You invented it. Yeah.
No. People have been going to other people's houses for dinner for decades.
Okay.
But we were looking to set up a website, and we didn't really know what to do. So we copied essentially the restaurants that we liked, like Freeman's, or any of the websites that weren't, or Diner, who had just like a page that said, this is our address. So we really were just like, let's just do a single page, black, simple. And if people have heard about it through their friends, then they will know to click here to send an email. Mm-hmm. That was it. It wasn't for like, let's provide a lot of information about our lives and provide some recipes for people and the way to interact online so that when they come to our house, they already have it didn't even occur to us to do anything like that.
That's fair enough. But when you arrive at this, it's like you have no idea what to expect. And chances are you will be blown away because it's quite an experience.
Well, I you know what? It's fun to set up people's expectations because New Yorkers love to consume things, especially new things they've never done before. Mm-hmm. And so we get a lot of people who send emails to us that are way beyond excitement. They border on like pathology. So we wonder, what are these people going to be like ourselves when they come in the door? But you can always see the difference between, I think, a restaurant. I walk into a restaurant, I'm always like in awe of the productions going on around me, like the opera of it all. But for me to see people who go into our place, you can tell their expectations shift immediately because they're thinking they're walking into something like a restaurant, and then they walk into somebody's house that's like visibly where we live, and they all of a sudden start behaving way better than they otherwise would.
Even
the people who I think would be like bossing me around if I were the wait staff are like, whoa, I'm in your house, whoa, I gotta behave. So I think that's something that you can't get, but I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about restaurants in general and why we like hosting like almost a restaurant in our house. But
was
you,
that the
you,
idea at first? You're like, I just love to cook and I want to have this cool experience with guests and make a sort of restaurant, but at home. Was that the idea?
It was. You know, I think it's hard to say. Nora started it 3 years before I got involved. Mm-hmm. She ran it all by herself, and to her, it was about cooking in her apartment because she didn't have the opportunity to cook at any time. She was in law school. There was no way that she had a way to invite her friends over for dinner. When Nora and I teamed up with Danielle and Nick, all the four of us were like, we have all these friends and we can invite them over to our house for dinner, but if our friends have something legitimate to point to, like, oh, this is a, it's a website with a name, it's not just your friend's house, because everybody gets invited to their friend's house for something.
Yeah.
Come to my friend Steve's, he's got a really cool foosball table. We didn't want to be like that. We didn't want to, oh, they have a bar with lots of booze in it. So we were like, you can point to your friends to this place that's somewhat legitimate. I don't think you would have come over if it was just your friend Amelia's house.
Yeah.
You know, or your Amelia's friend's house.
So it's kind of like one step further than like a home dinner party where you just get an email sent to 20 people, hey, come over for dinner. It's like, this is more of a, I guess, more of a public thing now, but word of mouth, really.
That's the best way to keep, I think that's the best way to keep it. I know that when I meet somebody out and they say, oh, I've always wanted to come, I know that that's something that means more to me than I think like an article I read online about it.
Right.
You know, like a human connection. It's like, oh, yes, let's meet over dinner in my house. I don't know what that means.
And the people that come now, they're for the most part new people, right? Or a lot of friends too, but
It's I would say, you know, we can serve about 25 people. So I would say it's split 25 people into maybe two groups of maybe 20 new, 5 old. It's nice to have old people there who get it, who are like very comfortable in our space.
Right.
And then 20 people who are like deer in headlights.
They're like, what? And just so you guys know, this supper club has a mailing list of, I don't know, thousands and the...
Like nine.
Nine.
So, I mean, really, we get emails like every day.
Every day. So seats sell out and huge waiting lists by... And you don't even invite the whole list, right?
There's no way to do that. it's very insulting to send somebody an email and be like, thank you for sending one back. I can't serve. There's like 70 people signed up for the dinner. It's not about the... I think it's more about, we just try to make sure that we reach out to people who I think our friends would have fun meeting, and people who would like to really tell us their story as well. So we meet a lot of people from other supper clubs, a lot of people who are running to cocktail collectives, who have amazing restaurants and who are interested.
That's another one, cocktail collectives. We see those pop up now too.
That's I think really fascinating stuff is, and I'm sorry that my roommate's car broke down because he was going to come and talk about, I guess, like the world
his cocktail.
Of
yeah, mixology. Nick runs the cocktail or the bar at Whisk and Lindle Supper Clubs, and he's a real great mixologist. It's definitely an integral part of the experience is trying these three or so custom cocktails made just for that night's meal.
Yeah, I think a bar is extremely important.
Advertising for something.
I know. I'm actually about to grill you, and I know it's your show, but why on earth did you come to our house? Because I met you almost 4 years ago.
Yes.
And you were a guest of a friend of ours who brought you along
the party
at the end of the dinner.
At the end of the dinner, I crashed, and I was like a deer in headlights. I knew Amelia, this mutual friend from food blogging, and she makes cookies, Sugarbilt, and she mentioned this thing she does called this Whisk and Lindle Supper Club. I was like, what the hell is that? And at that time, I was, I was doing Not Eating Out in New York, and I think I met her first at a picnic or like a food cooking class, something like that. So basically, I was trying to get out there and try to see and discover all these cool communal ways of cooking with people on a non-professional scale and a non, business-oriented way, but just doing it and making it fun. And when I heard about this thing, I was like, that's perfect. I need to learn more about it. So after I went to that night, I think I went to a real dinner, and I went on like a spree of going to all these different supper clubs.
That's right. That's right. And I remember meeting you, and I remember, I think you came back for dinner, and then you hung out afterwards. And then I think 4 or 5 of my friends asked me if I knew you. Like, do you know Kathy?
Oh.
Do you know her? And I'm like, yeah, she comes over sometimes. I don't really know her. She's just been here like twice. Oh, cool. All right. I just was wondering. And I was like, this guy is totally asking me to give Kathy's number to this. And it was amazing. It happened like 4 or 5 times in a row.
What?
Yeah. I was like, I'm your pimp. I could be doing a much better job of this.
Well, shoot. I better start another supper club. No, seriously, though.
You started a supper club, and that's extremely important to know. And that you also participated in this, so you know as much about this as I do, really.
So, since we're so knowledgeable, what is going to happen with supper clubs? What do you see is happening or changing gradually? Because I have some thoughts.
Okay. In the fall, we went to San Francisco, and I got to meet people who run 7 different supper clubs in San Francisco. I got to meet the guys at Spice, at Stag, what do I remember, Forage SF, who they host dinners as well as underground food markets of, mm-hmm. of enormous scale. I think the largest underground food market.
Is it foraged food?
Well, their food is all foraged. So their entire supper club
so
is based
cool.
on... It's incredible.
Only
so,
in San Fran, right?
Exactly. I think that's what I'm getting at. Is it, I met seven supper clubs suck. In San Francisco.
Actually,
all...
remember that Whisk and Ladle supper where I brought dandelion weeds?
From yeah. You picked dandelion... Kathy essentially picked dandelion weeds.
That'd be the worst supper club ever for New York City.
It was just terrifying anyway. For people from New York. I think we needed to like ship in a bunch of people from Portland to, you know,
yeah,
to enjoy
yeah.
that kind of experience, but...
Anyway, sorry to...
No. So we met a bunch of supper clubs who were way better than us. Way better than everybody in New York. I mean, they had... Each one was distinct from the other. And each had something to offer that I think was... They'd hosted dinners on rooftops, in garages, and mm-hmm. out on farms. And we also got to meet people from... what, Outstanding in the Field?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they host... They host 200 underground dinners a year.
But is this a business? Are these forge, you know, all these groups, is this their occupation or is this a side hobby like you guys?
No, these are legitimate businesses in a very San Francisco sense, in that you don't feel like you're talking to a salesman.
Interesting. And here, yeah.
Yeah. There's nobody who's pitching something to you. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the guys that I met, Blair from Graff Eats, it's like GRAFFEATS. An awesome guy. And they basically do like art dinners.
Oh, cool.
That's a really shitty way.
That's okay.
Okay. That's a terrible
heritage.
Way to describe it. So, but an amazing guy and charismatic and told me flat out, he said, you know, I wanted to be a Michelin star chef. Then I opened a restaurant and I was like hunting for a Michelin star.
Oh.
And now I just realized that this is probably actually a better way of going about
Whoa,
it.
Whoa, okay.
Is not doing it that way and doing it in a very like natural way where I actually enjoy what I'm doing and I enjoy the people I work with and I enjoy the projects I take on and the menus I make. And I was just like, where am I? I'm in some city that I, because I don't spend a lot of time in San Francisco, but everybody was really open to, they didn't even realize they were doing new things, I think.
Interesting.
There's no articles about them
right.
working on these great projects and...
But herein is the difference. They're doing it as a means of, supporting their life, their income.
That's true. And the Whisk and Ladle has never been about that. In fact, I think that's I think maybe the major problem with it.
Yeah.
Is that I don't depend on it for a living.
Right.
So it is.
And neither do you for throwing a dinner party, right? So
why?
This is like this is another
yeah.
step. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very good point. I think that we would be a lot more cautious about getting back to people on their emails and making sure that we opened up our doors to everybody who emailed. But it's like, it's not my job. I don't want it to become my job.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that these guys are basically running restaurant type businesses? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
And not, but they're doing something. So remember, wait a second. You grew up in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I think that's something we should talk about.
Okay.
Is that you've been to a lot of restaurants in New Jersey.
Yes.
Probably as a kid growing up. I'm from upstate New York, so the restaurants were like they were huge. And
oh.
they were like these it was like dining at Walmart. I don't think that I've ever had I didn't have intimate dining experiences until I was in college. So for
it's
me
a different
so,
world up there.
Yeah. So for me restaurants really that's what I remember growing up is going to like these gigantic and only when we were in Europe did I think this is so different from what
yeah,
I'm
you
used
could,
to.
Like, stand at a stool and eat and whatever.
or be there for 6 hours and not be thrown out.
Yeah. Huh. Well, let's have a quick break. We are going to throw on a little music and we'll be right back with Mark Lowe from Whisk and Ladle.
Yes, the lantern burn for a man easy. And following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Monday at 2 p.m., Snacky Tunes hosts some of today's most cutting-edge musicians and DJs. And while the requisite live radio fare is usually presented as a song here, a DJ set there, hosts Finger on the Pulse also talk food, sustainability, and green issues with their esteemed food guests. Snacky Tunes is routinely radio perfection for the music or food enthusiast. Again, that's every Monday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we're back on Let's Eat In. I'm Kathy Irway, Mark Lowe from Whiskey and Ladle Supper Club. We're just talking about some new trends in supper clubs, as you want to define them. I don't know how you would define them, actually. How would you define them?
I'm not answering that question. I don't even know what that means.
I know, because it's not always in a house, you know.
Okay, yeah.
You were just saying these people travel and they've hosted, Forage or one of them, they've held things in barns and... Outstaying in the field is all about holding them outside in farms.
Yes.
And so forth.
In galleries and on rooftops.
In galleries and rooftops.
Yeah. So I guess the future of a supper club is going to mirror what restaurants do too. I think there's a lot of interest in how restaurants restaurants are amazing at taking ideas from all sorts of places and sharing ideas with each other. And I think that when the people who run supper clubs will start their own businesses, I think they start to, not only do they start to reflect what restaurants are already doing.
Yeah, we were just talking off air about this, but I feel like in a lot of trends with restaurants right now, they're, it's funny enough, sounds a lot like supper clubs to me and to you. And you know, like from Co, where the waiters are the chefs, which is the case at Whisk and Ladle, right, and most of these places, and you get that intimate experience, to having a set pre-fee menu where you might not even know what the dinner is and people just go sign up. And also to these places that are changing their menus rapidly, like What Happens Next, in Lower East Side, I was reading about that, and Grant Ackett's new restaurant Next, which is going to turn over drastically the whole menu several times or maybe four times a year, something like that.
Yeah.
And also create these really well-orchestrated themes, because you do theme dinners all the time. When I started the Hoppe Kitchen Supper Club, our themes would be like, one night was Paris of the East, and it was like Shanghai and French food fused together with like gongs and girls wearing Mandarin dresses and ducks everywhere.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, and then Jason Anello runs a supper club called Real Tasty, where they design the entire menu based around the movie they're showing on a projector across the street. Mm-hmm. So you get, yeah, people very much are interested in that theme. The theme really holds strong to the menu and also to the the conversation at the tables.
Yeah, so just having fun with it. And also, when you have a restaurant where you fill the seats with people who are... RSVP in advance, usually online, mm-hmm. and they're definitely there. It's not like you're going to get drop-ins, and it just creates more of a communal, like, kind of party-like feel.
Yeah, you do end up, you have a shared destiny, which is so rare. I mean, that's not rare in New York at all. We have shared destinies when we're standing on the subway, but we never actually talk about these shared destinies. But no one's like, we're all on the 6 train together. What's this like?
That guy smells bad.
Yeah, are we all smelling
looking
this?
At each other grimacing. Yeah.
So having that and just bursting, because people tend to burst when they sit down at the table. They're like, oh my God, oh my God, I'm somewhere with you. I've never met you before.
Somebody once told me that was the main difference between restaurants and supper clubs, is that you're sitting at a communal table and you're talking to people, which you would never do that if you went to a restaurant.
Yes, exactly. And you can never predict how those things go. I think that's something that restaurants would have a tough time keeping a lid on, or keeping...
Some people just want to stay solitary too.
Yeah, of course. And there's something that's really like grained into the experience.
Yeah.
You were like, I'm going with this person,
yeah,
and I'm separate from the whole
world. And I'm eating at this time. I'm not eating all together at the same time, the same dishes as everybody else.
Yeah.
So
it actually shocks me a little bit, the people who like to go to supper clubs, because I sometimes think to myself, I don't know if I could sit through this whole meal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I could be here for like 2.5 hours in the same table with these same people. And I just think, like, I have to host this, otherwise I couldn't possibly go out there and eat. We had a dinner a couple weeks ago where this woman sat next to a group of four. It was like a woman and her date, and she sat next to a table or four other people at a 6-person table. So I was really terrified for her and her date because I thought to myself, she doesn't even know these people and they could be awful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I kept going over there and the four of them were just laughing so hard. And the other two were like very reserved and were just sort of like chuckling. And I was like, courtesy laughs. They're having a terrible night. Oh, I feel so bad. And then she came back a couple weeks later and was just like, oh my God, no, they were the best. It was like, we sat next to Jack LaLanne's son.
And what are you feeding these people?
I think they come in with no there were like a delusional expectation, so you don't really have to feed them anything.
Except, no, really, what is the weirdest thing you've fed people? Do you ever like poison things with like hallucinogenic? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't think we're doing anything that I haven't seen in some of the more exceptional restaurants. Okay. You could totally poison people and bury them out in Brooklyn somewhere, and nobody would know. There'd be a condo. There'd be a condo built above them the next week. I just got an email from Gastronauts. Do you know them?
Yeah.
The Gastronauts is a club. We hosted
We went to the Miracle Feud.
We went together.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was horrible.
So I've actually hosted two Gastronauts dinners, and the one that's coming up on, I think it's next, oh my God, it might even be tomorrow. But it's an amazing dinner, and they're doing it at Public. It's their 5-year anniversary. I mean, these guys have been together for 5 years. Getting people together to eat weird things, and there's like snake blood on the menu for their dinner on Tuesday.
That's totally normal in China.
Done. See that? See, so when you ask me the question, what is the weirdest thing you ever served? All I can think of is it's somewhere it's really normal. So okay, I don't want to get too outrageous about it. But we did a reptiles and amphibians dinner with the Gastronauts, so we served python and all this, all frogs and alligators and all the things that live in the swamps. And then we did a dinner of all beasts, like yak and black bear and things like that. All totally legal, illegally obtained. It wasn't any more illegal than I guess our regular dinners are. But but I think those things, I think there's adventurous eaters and they don't have to do that anymore. A lot of restaurants are really jazzing up their menu with one or two items that really spurs conversation, which is extremely important. You don't want to go to a restaurant and eat the same thing every time. Or if you do, there's restaurants for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think of places that name themselves Next or We're the Next Thing or something like that.
Or places with like all about awful head to toe eating and stuff like that, which is huge.
It's huge. Yeah. And it does a good job of making people who come to the restaurant have something to talk about throughout.
That's true.
And it gives them some like banter, which is nice because a big thing I think is that people are very food interested.
Yeah.
More so than they've ever been in history.
Maybe that's the overlying trend here is that people are just being more creative and more attuned to food. Whereas before, you know, maybe those restaurants that you're describing in upstate New York, the huge target size ones.
Yeah.
Would have, you know, typically beef, chicken, fish.
I go upstate and the conversations I have about, I mean, I love it up there. I love it. But the conversations I have up there are like, how big were those portions? So that's kind of like the code. Like the best.
We should do a dinner where it's really big portions.
Right. I think the best Thai restaurant in Albany is the best restaurant. Thai restaurant in Albany because it's the portions are huge.
$1 stretch.
You know, when we were kids, I'd never seen an avocado. You couldn't buy an avocado upstate New York at anywhere.
Oh,
you're from the metropolitan area.
Yeah.
So, but for where I grew up, that you couldn't get ingredients like that. And then I came home from college one summer and I just saw all these things in the grocery store that I thought to myself, stuff's arrived. People saw this on the Food Network and they wanted it.
Nice.
And it came, you know, like purple cauliflower.
Nice.
So you're right. I think this is the most food interested period of American culture. You know, the French have been food interested for centuries, right?
Well, yeah. And lots of parts. And we kind of derive from the French. Our culture derives from the Western, you know, food cultures.
Yeah.
Basically French.
Yeah. I mean, do you find that your parents were always talking about food and ingredients growing up? They must have.
Yeah, kind of.
You came from a very culinary background.
Well, yeah. You know, like other countries, though, they're like, my mom grew up in another, you know, in Taiwan, and they just cooked. I don't know. It's a different lifestyle. I will try to explain that better.
You should. But I only know this from your Flickr pictures. Like, I've looked at these feasts that your family has on Flickr, so That's what I know of you. I'm like, she must hang out with food all the time when she goes home, she goes back to her apartment to write for a blog.
Yeah, snakes blood every night. No, just kidding. So speaking of not snakes blood, because I don't imagine that would be the right on question or answer to this question, but most romantic date-worthy meal. Have you ever done something like that on your menus or?
Okay, this is a topic that hits home. You've written about this in your book.
Yes.
In the search for like
the search for the perfect date meal, and I ask every guest on the show, what would theirs be?
No way. I'm not going anywhere near that.
Oh.
No way. You can't have that. I think if you look for the perfect food, then you're on a date and you're eating, you're like, this is the perfect date food. Yeah. You need some work, but this food, this food's amazing. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, you don't want to make the perfect date should be the perfect date, not the food that you're eating, right?
But we're in such a food aware time.
Okay. All right. I'll cave.
Yay.
That was easy.
Yay.
Well, okay. So what's yours?
It's different all the time. It changes from time to time. I can't even think of it. I don't know. I can't think of
no
it
way.
Right now. Yeah.
All right. I would say, I think the perfect date meal is almost okay. So sometimes people ask me what your favorite thing to do on a night out in New York, and sometimes I like to go to rehearsals of things.
What?
Like ballet rehearsals or symphony rehearsals or my friends like bands recording something. I like going to these, like I like seeing a symphony rehearse. It's so much more fun than seeing the production of an actual symphony.
So cool.
And if you're a member of like a member of like American Ballet Theater or something like that, you can go to the rehearsals.
Walk in.
Yeah, and they'll give you certain dates you can go to rehearsals.
Whoa.
And those are mind blowing because something builds and then just stops, and all of the strings.
Oh my god!
All the strings essentially are visible. It's like it's like you can see the choreographer comes out and starts yelling, and people start freaking out.
You take notes and learn maybe a little.
You see in your daily life all the things that you do to build towards a meal.
Okay.
Like you're like, I put this meal together from scratch, and you see those people do the same thing. So I think the fascinating thing about it, I think the best perfect date meal would be going to like a cooking class or a butchery, or like going and seeing somebody build something from scratch.
Cool.
So, or like maybe the best meal is just to be maybe rent a farmhouse overlooking the ocean and cook a meal.
That sounds awesome.
So that to me is a perfect date meal. Not going to some the restaurants are great, but those are things that you go there for the conversation, not for like the food. The food's almost ancillary.
It's hands off.
Yeah, and it arrives. And in life, things don't just arrive. You know what I mean?
You have to work for this relationship. So
yeah,
you have
to you see somebody else's sweat, and they're covered in flour. And
oh, yeah, I was going to say, I think shucking oysters would be a fun one. Everyone says oyster is the most, like, aphrodisiac food because it's slippery and oozy and weird. And how many people really have shucked an oyster?
It's fun. Really. And even like the hospital visit.
And it's kind of weird and like sexual in a way because you have to get that sweet spot and really crank it and then. Whoa. Nice. It's intense.
Yeah. Yeah. Oysters.
That's mine.
Okay.
And yours is going to see rehearsals or go to camping and.
I think going back into a kitchen.
Okay. Going back into. Yeah.
And spending the day in a kitchen. In
that'd
a restaurant
cool.
kitchen or like some place where they do classes, taking a cooking class and really seeing how it develops and finishing a meal with a chef or something like that. More hands-on.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Tough question,
Kathy. My kind of answer. All right. So I guess that's about all the time we have, Mark. What's your next upcoming dinner theme?
Okay. We just did an event with these guys from the Noble Rot.
Yes.
Who are essentially creating these.
A wine supper club.
It's like a wine. Yeah. It's a wine bar that goes from place to place and introduces you to these. We had wines that were unlabeled, like fresh, brand new, newly bottled, not even out on the shelf yet kind of wines and we got to pair, the Whisking Ladle got to pair courses with them. So that was awesome. We have a dinner at the end of March and then we have some in May. So I don't really know what the plan is for those dinners. The one in March
That's
is just
fun.
A vegetarian menu.
Oh.
Which is something.
Hey, vegetarians, listen up.
and then in May, we're just, I don't know, probably collaborate with a few clubs and hopefully get somebody from San Francisco who we've met in the fall to come out and cook with us.
Yeah, maybe they could forage in the park and it'll go over really well.
I think that we'll I would see. Trust them to forage and then bring rather than forage anything around here. I'm such a...
Good stuff. Can't wait.
Thanks for having me. You are so good at this.
Thanks all to Jack Inslee and Patrick and everyone at Heritage, and we'll see you next week on Let's Eat In.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA. In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house, where it is boiled gently over a wood fire just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1-liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join wine impresarios Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco as they dish out on the latest industry news with winemakers and tastemakers on Heritage Radio Network's revamped wine show, Unfiltered. Erin Fitzpatrick, one of the first hosts on HRN with her program At the Root of It, amps up the volume and unfiltered content with co-host Brian DeMarco in this 2011 Redux. True to the original format, Erin and Brian will keep you abreast of current happenings and break down the news and global events, distilling complex into anecdotal stories that inspire. From media and political events to hailstorms in Argentina, no topic is out of bounds. Tune in every week to hear them chat up the industry's biggest personalities and host on-air tastings with visiting vintners and the country's hottest sommeliers. Whether you're an expert or an enthusiast, Unfiltered demystifies wine and lets you know what it really takes to get a bottle from the vineyard to your neighborhood wine shop. Unfiltered broadcasts live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.